Mike Landrake. I'm just the introducer, so I'm going to be very brief. First off, we do want people to please turn off their cell phones so that we don't have any problems. Second off, Dr. David Griffin will give his talk, and then he'll answer questions, and then he'll be prepared to sign a few books downstairs if you like. We have two people who will be handing out question cards, Bev in the back there, and Diane right over here, so we would like you to write your questions down on cards and give them to either of them anytime during the evening, and they'll bring them up here. We want to thank McAllister Plymouth United Church for providing this space. Very gracious. We appreciate that enormously. The pastor, a member who arranged this for us and has been doing a lot of work on bringing the truth out for many years now. I think that's it. I could run down a list of the books that David has written, but he has written more than anybody else earlier, with greater logical attention to detail and more persuasively than any other person that I know. So it's my extreme honor to introduce David Griffin.
Afghanistan, the United States, and the United Kingdom are illegal. In 2008, Cohen repeated his argument in an article entitled Afghanistan, the Other Illegal War. The point of the title was that, by then, most people agreed that the war in Iraq was illegal. So he was pointing out the one in Afghanistan is equally illegal. Her argument was based on the following facts. First, according to international law, as codified by the UN Charter, disputes are to be brought to the UN Security Council, which alone may authorize the use of force. Without this authorization, any military activity against another country is illegal. Second, there are two exceptions. One is that if your nation has been subjected to an armed attack by another nation, you may respond militarily in self-defense. This condition was not fulfilled by 9/11 because the attacks were not carried out by another nation. Afghanistan did not attack the United States. In fact, the 19 men charged with the attacks, none of them are from Afghanistan. The other exception occurs when one nation has certain knowledge that an armed attack by another nation is imminent, too imminent to bring the matter to the Security Council. The need for self-defense must be, in the generally accepted phrase, instant, overwhelming, leaving no choice of means, and no moment for deliberation. Although the U.S. government claimed that the need to prevent a second attack was urgent, this need, even if real, was clearly not urgent, as shown by the fact that the Pentagon did not launch its invasion until almost a month later. U.S. political leaders have claimed to be sure that the U.N. did authorize the U.S. attacks on Afghanistan. This claim, originally made by the Bush Cheney administration, was repeated by President Obama in his West Point speech of December 1, 2009, in which he said the United Nations Security Council endorsed the use of all necessary steps to respond to the 9/11 attacks. So U.S. troops went to Afghanistan under the banner of international legitimacy. However, the language of all necessary steps is from the UN Security Council Resolution 1368, in which the Council, taking note of its own responsibilities under the Charter, expressed its own readiness to take all necessary steps to respond to the terrorist attacks of 11 September 2001. Of course, the UN Security Council might have determined that one of those necessary steps was to authorize an attack by the United States, but it did not. Resolution 1373, the only other Security Council resolution about this issue, laid out various responses, but these included matters such as freezing assets, criminalizing the support of terrorists, exchanging police information about terrorists, and prosecuting terrorists. The use of military force was not mentioned. U.S. war in Afghanistan was not authorized by the UN Security Council in 2001 or any time since. So this war began as an illegal war and remains an illegal war today. Our government's claim to the contrary is false. This war is illegal, moreover, not only under international law, but also under U.S. law. The UN Charter is a treaty, which was ratified by the United States. And according to Article 6 of the U.S. Constitution, any treaty ratified by the United States is part of the supreme law of the land. The war in Afghanistan is therefore in violation of U.S. as well as international law. This war could not be more illegal. The American public, for the most part, is probably unaware of the illegality of this war, because this is not something our political leaders or our corporate media have been anxious to point out. So most people simply do not know. If they were informed, however, many Americans would be inclined to argue that, even if technically illegal, the U.S. military effort in Afghanistan has been morally justified by the attacks of 9/11. For a summary statement of this argument, we can turn again to the West Point speech of President Obama, who has taken over the Bush-Cheney account of 9/11. Answering the question of why America and our allies were first place, Obama said, "We did not ask for this fight. On September 11, 2001, 19 men hijacked 4 airplanes and used them to murder nearly 3,000 people. They struck at our military and economic nerve centers. They took the lives of innocent men, women, and children without regard to their faith or race or station. As we know, these men belong to Al-Qaeda, a group of extremists who have distorted and defiled Islam. After the Taliban refused to turn over Osama bin Laden, we sent our troops into Afghanistan." The standard account can be summarized in terms of 3 points. First, the attacks were carried out by 19 Muslim members of Al-Qaeda. Second, the attacks had been authorized by the founder of Al-Qaeda, Osama bin Laden, who was in Afghanistan. Third, the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan was necessary because the Taliban, which was in control of Afghanistan, refused to turn over bin Laden to U.S. authorities. On the basis of these 3 points, our political leaders have claimed that the United States had the moral right, arising from the universal right of self-defense, to try to capture or kill bin Laden and his Al-Qaeda network to prevent them from launching another attack on our country. This is a good argument, except for one problem. All 3 elements are false. I will deal with those 3 points in reverse order. The claim that the Taliban refused to turn over bin Laden has been repeatedly made by political leaders at our mainstream media. Reports from the time, however, show the truth to be very different. 10 days after the 9/11 attacks, CNN reported, "The Taliban refused to hand over bin Laden without proof or evidence that he was involved in last week's attacks on the United States." The Taliban ambassador to Pakistan said Friday that deporting him without proof would amount to an insult to Islam. CNN also made clear that the Taliban's demand for proof was not made without reason, saying, "Bin Laden himself has already denied he had anything to do with the attacks, and Taliban officials repeatedly said he could not have been involved in the attacks." Bush, however, said the demands were not open to negotiation or discussion. With this refusal to provide any evidence of bin Laden's responsibility, the Bush administration made it impossible for the Taliban to turn over bin Laden. As Afghan experts, quoted by the Washington Post, pointed out, the Taliban, in order to turn over a fellow Muslim to an infidel nation, needed a face-saving formula. Milton Burden, who had been a CIA station chief in Afghanistan in the 1980s, put it this way: while the United States was demanding give up bin Laden, the Taliban were saying, "Do something to help us give him up." But the Bush administration refused. After the bombing began in October, the Taliban tried again, offering to turn over bin Laden to a third country if the United States would stop the bombing and provide proof of bin Laden's responsibility. But Bush replied, "There's no need to discuss innocence or guilt. We know he's guilty." An article in London's Guardian, which reported this development, was entitled, "Bush Rejects Taliban Offer to Hand Over Bin Laden." So it was the Bush administration, not the Taliban, that was responsible for the fact that bin Laden was not handed over. In August of 2009, President Obama, who had criticized the U.S. invasion of Iraq as a war of choice, said of the U.S. involvement in Afghanistan, "This is not a war of choice. This is a war of necessity." But the evidence shows, as we have seen, it too was a war of choice. This conclusion is reinforced by reports indicating that the United States had made the decision to invade Afghanistan 2 months before the 9/11 attacks. The background to this decision was the United States' long-term support for a pipeline project proposed by UNICAL, which would transport oil and gas from the Caspian Sea region to the Indian Ocean through Afghanistan and Pakistan. This project had been stymied through the 1990s because of the civil war that had been going on in Afghanistan ever since the Soviet withdrawal in 1989. mid-1990s, the U.S. government had supported the Taliban with the hope that its military strength would enable it to unify the country and provide a stable government that would be able to protect the pipeline. By the late 1990s, however, the Clinton administration had given up on the Taliban. When the Bush administration came to power, it decided to give the Taliban one last chance. During a four-day meeting in Berlin in July 2001, representatives of the Bush administration insisted that the Taliban must create a government of national unity by sharing power with factions friendly to the United States. The U.S. representative reportedly said, "Either you accept our offer of a carpet of gold, or we bury you under a carpet of bombs." The Taliban refused this offer, after which the Americans repeatedly said, "Military action in Afghanistan would go ahead before the snow started falling in Afghanistan by the middle of October at the latest." And indeed, given the fact that the 9/11 attacks occurred on 9/11, the U.S. military was ready to start the invasion on October 7th. It appears, therefore, that the United States invaded Afghanistan for reasons far different from the official rationale, according to which we were there to capture or kill Osama bin Laden. I turn now to the second point, the claim that Osama bin Laden had authorized the attacks. Even if it refused to give the Taliban evidence for this claim, the Bush administration, most Americans probably assume, surely had such evidence and provided it to those who needed it. But the reports from the time indicate otherwise. 2 weeks after 9/11, Secretary of State Colin Powell said that he expected in the near future to put out a document that will describe quite clearly the evidence that we have linking bin Laden to the attack. But at a joint press conference with President Bush the very next morning, Powell had to take back this pledge, saying that most of the evidence is classified. Seymour Hersh, citing officials from both the CIA and the Department of Justice, said that the real reason why Powell withdrew the pledge was a lack of solid information. The following week, British Prime Minister Tony Blair issued a document to show that Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda, the terrorist network which he heads, planned and carried out the atrocities of 11 September 2001. Blair's report, however, began by saying, "This document does not purport to provide a prosecutable case against Osama bin Laden in a court of law." So it was good enough to go to war, but not good enough to go to court. The next day, the BBC emphasized this weakness, saying, "There is no direct evidence in the public domain linking Osama bin Laden to the 11 September attacks." What about our own FBI? Its most wanted terrorist page on Osama bin Laden does not list 9/11 as one of the terrorist attacks for which he is wanted. And I'm curious, how many of you already knew that? How many did not? About half and half. Could it be our mainstream media didn't report this? When asked why it didn't list Osama bin Laden as wanted for 9/11, the chief of investigative publicity said, "Because the FBI has no hard evidence connecting bin Laden to 9/11. You'd think that might be front page news. What about the 9/11 Commission? Its entire report is based on the assumption that bin Laden was behind the attacks. However, the report's evidence to support this premise has been disowned by the Commission's own co-chairs, Thomas Kane and Lee Hamilton. This evidence consisted of testimony that had reportedly been elicited by the CIA from Al-Qaeda operatives. The most important of these operatives was Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, generally known as KSM, the one that all the debates about are where they have the trial. He's been called the mastermind of 9/11. If you read the 9/11 Commission's account of how bin Laden planned the attacks, and then check the notes in the back of the book, you will find that virtually every bit of evidence indicates that the information came from KSM. In 2006, Kane and Hamilton wrote a book called Without Precedent, giving the inside story of the 9/11 Commission, in which they called this information untrustworthy. They had no success, they reported, in obtaining access to star witnesses in custody, most notably colleague Sheikh Mohammed. It's not about being allowed by the CIA to interview KSM. They were not permitted to observe the interrogation through a one-way glass. They were not even allowed to talk to the interrogators. Therefore, Kane Hamilton complained, we have no way of evaluating the credibility of the detainee information. How could we tell if someone such as colleague Sheikh Mohammed was telling the truth? They could not. Accordingly, neither the Bush administration, British government, the FBI, nor the 9/11 Commission has ever provided reliable evidence of Bin Laden's responsibility for 9/11. Some people argue to be sure that such evidence is no longer necessary because Bin Laden admitted his responsibility in a videotape that was discovered in November 2001. But Bin Laden had previously denied his involvement many times. And some Bin Laden experts call this later video a fake, and for good reasons. Many of the physical features of the man in the video are different from those of Osama bin Laden. And this man said many things that Osama bin Laden simply would not accept. I've documented all this in some of my books, most recently in a little book called Osama bin Laden Dead or Alive. So to review the first 2 points, the Taliban said it would turn over bin Laden if our government had given it good evidence of his responsibility, but our government did not. And good evidence of this responsibility has never been given to the public. I turn now to the third point. Even if there is no proof that Osama bin Laden authorized the attacks, many people would say, we have abundant evidence that attacks were carried out by Muslims belonging to his Al-Qaeda organization. This is still widely assumed. The truth, however, is that the evidence in favor of Al-Qaeda hijackers falls completely apart upon examination. And this suggests that 9/11 was instead a false flag attack, an attack that people within our own government orchestrated while planning evidence to implicate Muslims. Now, I'm only going to give a couple of illustrations here. I have discussed it at great length in my 2008 book, The New Pearl Harbor Revisited. And if I may brag for a second, people say, oh, those conspiracy theorists, they just make stuff up and they don't know anything about research, they don't know anything about anything. And nevertheless, this book, some of you know what Publishers Weekly is. It's really the Bible for booksellers and librarians. It tells them of all the books published in the English language this last week, which few are worth buying. So they list a bunch, and then they star a few of them, and then each week, one gets named Pick of the Week, Best Book of the Week. So only 51 of those a year. November, third week of November 2008, New Pearl Harbor was named Pick of the Week. Now you would think the New York Times would say, hey, look at that. One of these conspiracy theorists named the Pick of the Week. Man, we got to interview, we got to at least write a book report about the guy. No. Let us begin with the 9/11 Commission's claim that the men who took over the planes but were devout Muslims, ready to sacrifice their lives for the cause. The San Francisco Chronicle reported that Otta and other hijackers had made at least 6 trips to Las Vegas. where they had engaged in some decidedly un-Islamic sampling of prohibited pleasures. Somebody can write. The Chronicle then quoted the head of the Islamic Foundation of Nevada saying, "True Muslims don't drink, don't gamble, don't go to strip clubs." Contradiction is especially strong with regard to Muhammad Ali, considered the ringleader. On the one hand, according to the 9/11 Commission, he was very religious, even fanatically so. This characterization was supported by Professor Dietmar Makuli, who was Ali's thesis supervisor at a technical university in Hamburg in the 1990s. Professor Makuli says he knew a student only as Muhammad El Mir, although his full name was indeed the same as his father's, Muhammad Al Omir Ali. In any case, this professor said that this student was very religious, prayed regularly, and never touched alcohol. According to the American Press, on the other hand, Muhammad Ali drank heavily, and one night after five glasses of vodka, shouted an Arabic word that Newsweek said roughly translates as, now unfortunately I'm not on the Jon Stewart show, so I don't have anything to bleep it out, but it is F-K God. Investigative reporter Daniel Hopsicker, who wrote a book about Otter, stated that Otter regularly went to strip clubs, hired prostitutes, drank heavily, and even took cocaine. Otter even lived with a stripper for several months, and then, after she kicked him out, he came back, took a knife, disemboweled, and mutilated her cats and kittens and left them strewn on the kitchen floor. Could this be the same individual as Professor Makuli's student, Muhammad Al-Amir, who would not even shake hands with a woman upon meeting her, and who never touched alcohol? Professor Makuli said, "I would put my hand in the fire that this Muhammad Al-Amir that I know will never taste or touch alcohol." Could the author described by Hopsicker in the American Press be the young man whom this professor described as not a bodyguard type, but more a girl-looking type? Could the man who disemboweled kittens be the young man known to his father as a gentle and tender boy who was nicknamed by his parents Nightingale? We are clearly talking about different men. This is confirmed by the differences in their appearance. The American Otter was often described as having a hard, cruel face, and the standard FBI photo of him bears this out. The face of the Hamburg student was quite different, and photos available on the internet show this. Also, his professor described him as very small, being 1.62 meters in height, which means slightly under 5'4". Whereas the American Otter has been described as 5'8 and even 5'10". One final reason to believe that these different descriptions apply to different men. The father of Muhammad Al-Amir Otter reported that on September 12th, before either of them had learned about the attacks, his son called him, and they spoke for 2 minutes about this and that. There are also problems in relation to many of the other alleged hijackers. For example, the BBC reported that Wali Al-Ashiri, who supposedly died with Otto on American Flight 11, the 9/11 Commission even speculated that he was the one who stabbed one of the flight attendants, that he spoke to journalists and American authorities in Casablanca the following week. This is the BBC reporting this. Moreover, there were clearly two men going by the name Ziad Girard, the name of the alleged pilot of the manned flight 93. Accordingly, besides the fact that the men labeled the hijackers not without Muslims, they may not have been Muslims. And if that were not bad enough for the official story, there is no good evidence that these men were even on the planes. All the evidence for this claim plan falls apart upon examination. Now, I know a lot of people think, no, that's going too far. But I was kind of surprised to learn this myself. I didn't come to this till I've been working on these problems for several years. And this is all in the New Pearl Harbor Revisited. That really good book that I mentioned. I will illustrate this point with only a couple of examples in the book. There are about 10. One of the purported proofs that the 19 men identified as the hijackers were on the plane was the reported discovery of some of their passports at crash sites. But these reports are not believable. For example, the FBI claimed that while searching the streets after the destruction of the World Trade Center, they discovered the passport of Saddam al-Sudan, one of the hijackers on American Flight 11, which had crashed into the North Tower. But for this to be true, passport would have had to survive the collapse of the North Tower, which for some strange reason pulverized virtually everything in the building except the steel and Sukhani's passport into fine particles of dust. This claim was too absurd to pass the Google test, and it was eventually modified. By 2004, the claim was that a passerby had picked it up and gave it to a New York Police Department detective shortly before the World Trade Center collapsed. So it didn't have to survive the collapse of the North Tower. All it had to do was somehow escape from the hijacker's pocket, then escape from the cabin of the plane, and then escape from the building with that giant fireball without being burned up or even singed. This version was no less ridiculous than the first one. And the other stories about passports at crash sites are equally absurd. Now, we're going to have a Q&A at the end, so if you want to hear even funnier story, ask me about the passport from Flight 93. It is widely believed, of course, that we know that there were hijackers on the airlines thanks to numerous phone calls from the passengers and crew members, in which they reported the hijackings and described the hijackings. But we have good reasons to believe that these calls never occurred. And again, you're probably going to think, that's a stretch. Again, I have to ask you to read the book. But I'll give a couple of examples. About 15 of the reported calls from the airliners were said to have been made on cell phones. In fact, these were generally the most famous of the calls. And about 10 of those calls were said to be from one flight, United Flight 93, the plane that allegedly crashed in Pennsylvania. 3 or 4 of those calls were received by one person, Dina Burnett, who said that she knew her husband, Tom Burnett, had called her using his cell phone because she saw his number on her caller ID. There was Tom's cell phone number. Could be no doubt about it. He called on his cell phone. However, given the cell phone technology available in 2001, high-altitude cell phone calls from airlines, we're talking 35,000, 40,000 feet, were strictly impossible, technologically impossible. Articles describing the impossibility of the calls were published in 2003 and 2004 by two well-known Canadians, A.K. Dewdney, formerly a columnist for the Scientific American, and world-famous economist Michel Chodorkovsky. Perhaps in response, the FBI changed the story. In 2006, it had to present a report on the cell phones calls, the phone calls from all the planes to the trial of Zacharias Moussaoui. Remember the so-called 20th hijacker? And in this report, when it got to Flight 93, it said that cell phone calls were used for only 2 of the calls. And both of those were when the plane was about to crash, so it was down at a low altitude. So you can see the FBI agreed, high-altitude cell phone calls were not possible. Now, that got rid. They no longer have to defend that technologically impossible claim, but it creates another problem. How do we explain how so many people reported that they received calls from cell phones? Now, in most cases, they were reporting what the person who called them said. I'm using a cell phone. I borrowed my neighbor's cell phone. Now you might say, well, they misheard, they misunderstood, they misremembered, possibly. Though it would be strange if so many people misremembered, misheard the same thing. But let's say that you do that. Even if you discount all those, what do you do about Dina Burnett? She wasn't remembering something that someone, or mid-hearing something somebody said to her. She's reporting what she saw on her caller ID. And no memory lapse is possible here. We're talking about the FBI went to her house in a matter of hours. She reported it that very day. We have the FBI report in which they report that she said Tom called her on his cell phone. She had seen it on her caller ID. So how do we explain that? Seems to me there's only one possibility. These calls were faked. Now, how do you fake these calls? Well, there is the technology, voice morphing. This was discussed in a 1999 Washington Post story about voice morphing. The guy heard Colin Powell's voice saying something, and everybody in the room would have sworn it was Colin Powell, but it was not. It was a voice morphing of his voice. They did another check, same thing. There are devices that you can fake the caller ID. That's one possibility. Another is somebody just taken Tom's phone and called Dina from the ground. But in either case, she did not receive calls from her husband's cell phone from flight 93. Now, that's one. The conclusion that the calls must have been fake is reinforced by the FBI's report on phone calls from American Flight 77, the one that supposedly struck the Pentagon. Ted Olson, U.S. Solicitor General, do you remember him? He's the one who argued before the Supreme Court that the vote count in Florida should be stopped, the vote recount that would have made Al Gore president. So we have Ted Olson to thank for the Bush-Cheney administration. So he's a pretty important person. Anyway, that morning he reported that his wife, Barbara Olson, you remember her, very well-known commentator on CNN, he reported that she called him from Flight 77 that morning and reported that the plane had been taken over by hijackers who were armed with knives and box cutters. I emphasize that, box cutters, because of all the alleged phone calls, this was the only one that mentioned box cutters. And yet the whole world knows the hijackers had box cutters. That gives you an idea of how central this story was to the official mythology about 9/11. So, what did the FBI report say about it? Now, there were some problems. What kind of phone did she use? Ted went back and forth. One time he said, first said cell phone, and the next time he gave an interview, he said seatback phone. And then he went back to cell phone and went back to the seatback phone. And it would be a puzzle because the plane was too high for a cell phone call. And unfortunately for the official story, the plane that hit the Pentagon, they said, Flight 77, this was a 757, Boeing 757. The 757s that were made for America, unlike those that were made for United Airlines, did not have seatback phones. We discovered that in 2006. And since then, it's been confirmed by American pilots. Just 2 weeks ago, I met a flight attendant who had flown these planes. And she said, absolutely no onboard folks. What's the... Well, I don't know if this was the reason, but here's what they said. When they got to Flight 77, the one down the list, here's what they said about Barbara Olson. They did mention her name, and they did say that she attempted a call. But they said she attempted one call. Now, Ted reported that he was called twice. The first one lasted about a minute. The second one lasted 3 or 4 minutes. But the report says she attempted one call, but it was unconnected, and therefore it lasted 0 seconds. Now, this is pretty amazing. The FBI is part of the Department of Justice. And now the FBI says that these famous phone calls reported by the former Solicitor General for the Department of Justice, that report is untrue. Again, you might have expected we should have a front page story. In any case, the FBI report allows only two possibilities. Either Ted Olson engaged in deception, or he, like Dina Burnett, was duped by fake calls. In any case, the story about Barbara Olson's calls with the reports of hijackers taking over Flight 77 was based on deception. The alleged phone calls, therefore, do not provide trustworthy evidence that there were hijackers on the planes. In addition to the lack of evidence for the presence of hijackers on the planes, we even have good evidence for their absence. That there were none. One of those is a psychiatrist used a FOIA request, Freedom of Information Act request, to get the autopsy report from the Pentagon attack. And it took him a long time. They didn't want to give it up, but finally they had to. And he looked at it and found none of the hijackers' names from that flight were on the autopsy list. In fact, there were no Arab names whatsoever. Likewise, the passenger manifests for all four flights, none of them have any hijacker names on them. None of them have any Arab names. And then here's the clincher. Y'all know this, the Sherlock Holmes story about the dog that didn't bark. You know that the racehorse Silver Blaze was stolen just the night before the big race, and the stupid Scotland Yard inspector thinks, oh, well, there was a intruder came in, stole a horse. And Sherlock Holmes gets there and he says, I don't think so. And, well, why not? Well, the curious thing of the dog in the night. And the inspector said, what do you mean? The dog didn't do anything. That was the curious incident. In other words, if there had been an intruder, the dog would have barked. Likewise, on these airplanes, every cockpit has a transponder. There's a universal hijack code, 7500. It takes about 2 seconds to put that code in there, and it signals the ground crew, the FAA on the ground, that there's a possible hijack in the process. Of all four planes, you got two pilots on each one. Nobody put in the hijack code. This is called squawking the hijack code. Nobody squawked the code. So, just as the intruder theory in the Holmes story was disproved by the dog that didn't bark, the intruder theory in 9/11 is disproved by the pilot who didn't squawk. I think that's a nice proof. So, it appears that 9/11 was the most elaborate example yet of a false flag attack, which occurs when countries wanting to attack other countries orchestrate attacks on their own people while planning evidence to implicate the enemy they want to attack. Hitler did this when he was ready to invade Poland. That's how World War II got started in Europe. The Japanese did it when they were ready to invade Manchuria. That's how the Asian part of World War II got started. These are very common things. After Castro took back Cuba for the Cubans, the Joint Chiefs of Staff came to President Kennedy with a document called Operation Northwoods. The subtitle was Pretext for Invading Cuba. And some of those pretexts included killing American citizens and blaming the Cubans. So it's not just the Japanese and the Germans that do these heinous things. We did it to start the Mexican-American War. And a congressman named Abraham Lincoln said that the official story about this was the sheerest deception. I turn now to the strongest evidence. Oh, let me finish up on Operation Northwoods. Kennedy did not authorize the invasion. But in 2009, we had an administration in the White House that was chomping at the bit to attack both Afghanistan and Iraq. And so it appears that evidence was planted to implicate Muslims. In fact, not only Iraq and Afghanistan, they had seven predominantly Muslim countries on their hit list. This has even been admitted now by one of the leading neocons. And one of them, believe it or not, our firm ally, Saudi Arabia, was on our hit list. Why? They've got a little oil. I turn now to the strongest evidence that the 9/11 attacks were orchestrated by insiders rather than foreign terrorists. The collapse of Building 7 of the World Trade Center, which is the subject of my most recent book, The Mysterious Collapse of World Trade Center 7, by the final official report about 9/11, is unscientific and false. I speak of the mysterious collapse because from the very beginning, the collapse of this building was seen as the biggest mystery of 9/11. Given the fact that the Twin Towers were hit by planes, which started big fires, most people evidently thought it was understandable that these buildings came down. But Building 7 was not hit by a plane, and yet it came down at 5:21 that afternoon. This would have meant, assuming that it was not deliberately demolished with explosives, that this building had been brought down by fire alone, and this would have been an unprecedented occurrence. New York Times writer James Glantz wrote, "Experts said no building like it, a modern steel-reinforced high-rise, had ever collapsed because of an uncontrolled fire." Glantz then quoted a structural engineer saying, "Within the structural engineering community, Building 7 is considered to be much more important to understand than the Twin Towers, because engineers had no answer to the question, why did 7 come down?" Moreover, although Glantz spoke of an uncontrolled fire, there were significant fires on only 6 of this building's 47 floors. And these fires were visible for at most 3 to 4 hours. And yet fires have burned in other steel-framed high-rise buildings for 17 or 8 hours, turning them into real towering infernals, and never produced a collapse, not a collapse of a single floor. Steel works. So why did Building 7 come down? FEMA, which in 2002 put out the first official report on this building, admitted that its best hypothesis had only a low probability of occurrence. If some of you are scientists, you know that science speak for, we don't have a clue. By its best hypothesis, FEMA meant the best hypothesis it could come up with in light of the fact that, as a government agency, it could not posit the use of explosives. Now, why might anyone think that explosives had brought this building down? One reason is simply that, prior to 9/11, every collapse of a steel-framed high-rise building, at least 100 of these, was brought about by explosives and the procedure known as controlled demolition. Collapse has never been caused by fire, by earthquakes, or anything else other than explosives. Another reason to talk about explosives is that this building came down, straight down, collapsing into its own footprint. For this to happen, all of this building's 82 steel support columns had to fail simultaneously, within a split second of each other. This is what happens in the kind of controlled demolition known as implosion, where you take out the support and the walls fall in on itself. And if you see the pictures of Building 7 after its collapse, it's a very tiny pile, relatively tiny given the fact that it was a 47-story building. This is not something that fires can do. Simply seeing a video of the building coming down makes it obvious to anyone with knowledge of these things that it was brought down by explosives. On 9/11 itself, CBS News anchor Dan Rather, we always say Dan Rather, bless his heart. CBS News anchor Dan Rather said, "It's reminiscent of those pictures we've all seen on television where a building was deliberately destroyed by well-placed dynamite to knock it down." That was September 11th. You'd be sure that never ran again on CBS. In 2006, a filmmaker named Danny Yowinko, the owner of a controlled demolition company in the Netherlands, was asked to comment on a video of the collapse of Building 7 without telling him what it was, even though Yowinko was a controlled demolition expert. This is his field. He had never heard that Building 7 came down. They had done a very good job secret. In fact, some of you know, the 9/11 Commission report in their 571 pages didn't have a single sentence devoted to Building 7 to mention that, oh, it collapsed too. And this report got delayed on Building 7, delayed, until 2008. Well, after viewing the video, Yowinko said they simply blew up columns and the rest caved in afterwards. This was a controlled demolition. When he was asked if he was certain, he replied, "Absolutely, it's been imploded. This was a hired job. A team of experts did it." An organization called Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, which was formed in 2006, now has over 1,200 members. When I did an interview with Amy Goodman on Democracy Now! Several years ago, she was not a sympathetic interviewer. And in fact, she brought on a hitman. And his big point was, if this were true, you would have engineers supporting your position. How many engineers do you have? And I said, "Well, we don't have any right now." I did have one in Mexico who was going to come out, and then he chickened out at the last. Just about a week before I went on the show, but I couldn't name anybody. And that was taken then as the proof that this story must not be true because we needed some engineers. That seemed to imply, well, if you had a whole bunch of licensed engineers, then sure, we believe it. Well, now there are 1,200 licensed architects and engineers which have signed a document saying that there needs to be a new investigation of the road. You go by precedent and say, well, okay, 100 times, it's always been this way, so it must have been this way. No. When NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology, which was assigned the task of putting out the official report that took over from FEMA, NIST said the challenge was to determine if a fire-induced floor system failure could occur in World Trade Center 7 under an ordinary building contents fire. So, although every other steel frame building that has collapsed did so because explosives were used to destroy its support columns, NIST said, in effect, we think fire caused this one to come down. Now, to understand why they would have started with such an implausible hypothesis, You have to understand that NIST is an agency of the Commerce Department. And therefore, during the 8 years it was working on these reports, it was an agency of the Bush-Cheney administration. A scientist who had worked for NIST reported that by 2001, it had been fully hijacked from the scientific into the political realm. So that scientists working there had lost their scientific independence and became little more than hired guys. One manifestation of this political nature may be the fact that it delayed its report on Building 7 year after year, releasing it only late in 2008 while the Bush-Cheney administration was preparing to leave office. Be that as it may, NIST did in August of 2008 finally put out a report in the form of a draft for public comment, announcing this preliminary draft report at a press conference. Shyam Sunder, NIST lead investigator, said, "Our take-home message today is that the reason for the collapse of World Trade Center 7 is no longer a mystery. World Trade Center 7 collapsed because of fires fueled by office furnishings. It did not collapse from explosives." Sunder added that science is really behind what we have said. However, far from being supported by good science, NIST report repeatedly makes its case by resorting to scientific fraud. Two of the major types of scientific fraud as defined by the National Science Foundation are fabrication, which is making up results, and falsification, which means either changing or omitting data. I will begin in the falsification. Claiming that it found no evidence of a controlled demolition event, NIST simply omitted or distorted all such evidence, some of which was testimonial. Two city officials, Barry Jennings of the Housing Authority and Michael Hess, the city's corporation counsel, and Rudy Giuliani's good friend, reported that they had become trapped by a massive explosion in Building 7 shortly after they arrived there at 9 a.m. However, NIST claimed that what they called an explosion was really just the impact of debris from the collapse of the North Tower, which was about 2 football fields away. But Jennings explicitly said that they were trapped before either of the Twin Towers came down, which means that the explosion he reported had occurred before 9:59, which is when the first tower, the South Tower, came down. The North Tower didn't come down until 10:28. So this is saying what Jennings and Hess reported really occurred at 10:28, at least an hour after. So it seems pretty clear that they distorted Hess and Jennings' testimonial evidence. Colleagues of mine sent to NIST and used a FOIA request and said we would like you to release the interview that you had with Hess and Jennings. And they said this is not subject to FOIA request because this would endanger national security. Other people reported that explosions went off in the late afternoon when the building started to come down. Reporter Peter DeMarco of the New York Daily News said, "There was a rumble. The building's top row windows popped out. Then all the windows on the 39th floor popped out. Then the 38th floor, pop, 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 was all you heard until the building sunk into a rising cloud of gray." NIST dealt with all such testimonies by, what would you guess? Just ignoring it. NIST also ignored a lot of physical evidence that Building 7 was brought down by explosives. For example, three professors from Worcester Polytechnic Institute, one of our leading technical institutes, discovered a piece of steel from Building 7 that had melted so severely that it had holes in it. And so it was described as looking like a piece of Swiss cheese. New York Times pointing out that the fires in the building could not have been hot enough, nearly hot enough, to melt the steel, called this the deepest mystery uncovered in the investigation. The three professors and report included as an appendix to the 2002 FEMA report said, a detailed study into the mechanisms of this phenomenon is needed. When NIST report on Building 7 appeared, by the way, when NIST took over from FEMA, they said, we will follow all their recommendations. But when the NIST report came out, it did not mention this mysterious piece of steel. It even claimed that no recovered steel from this building had been identified, directly contradicting what the Worcester Polytechnic Institute professors had said. This is how bold they are and simply lying. And this was just the beginning of NIST's omission of physical evidence. The nearby Deutsche Bank building was heavily contaminated by dust when the World Trade Center towers came down. But the bank's insurance company refused to pay off, saying, oh, this wasn't from the World Trade Center event. This is just ordinary building dust. So Deutsche Bank hired a research organization known as the RJB Group to do a study. And their study showed that this building, its dust, had a unique chemical signature. Part of this signature was spherical iron particles. And this meant, RJB Group said, that iron had melted during the World Trade Center event, producing spherical metallic particles. By the way, not just a little bit of iron. The normal amount of iron in building dust is about 0.04%. In the World Trade Center dust, it was almost 6%. That is an enormous amount of iron to have in the dust. Iron does not melt until it reaches 2800 degrees Fahrenheit, which is about 1,000 degrees hotter than the fires in the building could have possibly been under the most ideal circumstances, which did not obtain. And nevertheless, the RJD study also found that temperatures had been reached at which lead would have undergone vaporization, meaning over 3,000 degrees Fahrenheit. Another study was carried out by scientists at the U.S. Geological Survey, a U.S. government agency. And besides finding iron particles, these scientists found molybdenum, which is notorious for having an extremely high melting point, almost 5,000 degrees. All this is contained in a paper by physicists and scientists called Extremely High Temperatures in the World Trade Center buildings. These two studies proved, RJB Group and the U.S. Geological Survey, that something had produced temperatures many times higher than the fires could have produced. NIST, however, made no mention of these studies. But even this was not the end of its omission of evidence. A report by several scientists, including the University of Copenhagen chemist Niels Herrick, showed that the World Trade Center dust contained unreacted nanothermite. Now, ordinary thermite has been around for a long time, and it's an incendiary. But nanothermite is a rather recent invention, and it is a high explosive, an extremely powerful explosive. This report by Herrick and his colleagues did not appear until 2009, several months after the publication of NIST's final report in November 2008. So they couldn't have reported on that. But NIST should have, as a matter of routine, tested the World Trade Center dust for signs of incendiaries, such as ordinary thermite, explosives, and nanothermite. There are standard manuals to tell you these are the things to check for. And that's why they should have done it. It's part of the normal procedure. When asked whether it did, NIST said no. When a reporter asked Michael Newman, a NIST spokesman, why not, Newman replied, because there was no evidence of that. The reporter scratched her head and said, well, how can you know there's no evidence if you don't look for it first? Newman replied, if you're looking for something that isn't there, you're just wasting your time and the taxpayers' money. You really couldn't make this stuff up. You would never. If any of you are script writers and you were writing a script with a, like this, a play or a TV show, they'd throw it out and say, nobody would say anything so stupid.
Bush would.
Besides omitting and distorting evidence to deny the demolition theory of Building 7 for the last, I want to see that man after the event. Besides omitting and distorting evidence to deny the demolition theory of Building 7's collapse, NIST also fabricated evidence, simply made it up to support its own theory. NIST's explanation as to how the fire caused Building 7 to collapse starts with thermal expansion, meaning that the fires heated up the steel, which then expanded. An expanding steel beam on the 13th floor, NIST claims, caused a steel girder that was attached to the column, to break loose. Having lost its support, this column failed, starting a chain reaction in which the other 81 columns all fell. This is NIST's theory of progressive collapse, one after another after another. Ignoring the question of whether this is even remotely plausible, I see a man there who doesn't believe it. Let us simply ask, why did that girder fail? Because, NIST claimed, it was not connected to the floor slab with shear studs. Shear stud girder, pretty big stud if it bolts up to the floor. And NIST wrote, in World Trade Center 7, no studs were installed on the girders. Another passage. Floor beams had shear studs, but the girders that supported the floor beams did not have shear studs. Now, that's 2008. But if you look back at NIST's interim report on World Trade Center 7, which came out in 2004, before they had developed this theory of thermal expansion involving the girders, here's what it says. That the girders as well as the beams had been attached to the floor by means of shear studs. In this new report, they just quote that paragraph almost word for word and just leave out "and girders." Another case of fabrication is a graphic in this report. See, everything in the report is computer-based. They had no physical evidence left. They just had videos and testimonies and could say ignored most of it. And they just fed data into a computer and then produced graphics to show you here's how the fire progressed according to the data they fed in. And so their graphic about the 12th floor, their theory orients around floors 11, 12, and 13 of this building. They said those are the three crucial floors that made the building come. So, on 4/12, at 5 o'clock in the evening, you see a graphic showing a huge fire over the front of the north face. This claim is essential to NIST's explanation as to why the building collapsed at 5/21. But if you look back again at that same 2004 report, you will find this statement. At 4:45 p.m., a photograph showed fires on floors 7, 8, 9, and 11 near the middle of the north face. Floor 12 was burned out by this time. Other photographs showed that the 12th floor fire had virtually burned out by 4 o'clock. And yet NIST, in its final report, claims that there was raging fire going on still at 5 o'clock. This is fabrication big time. In addition to omitting falsification and fabrication of evidence, NIST does one other no-no. It affirms a miracle. there's some scientists here, you know, that's one thing you absolutely cannot do in giving a scientific report. You can't say, well, this happened because some laws of physics were violated. In fact, you may know this famous cartoon. The professor is up on the board and writing all these formula X, Z, certain, you know, and equations and equals and therefores. But one step says, and then a miracle happens. You can't do that in science, but NIST does it in their final report. Even after all this lying, they still have to affirm a miracle. Here's how. Members of the 9/11 Truth Movement have been saying for years that Building 7 came down in virtually free fall acceleration. Virtually, if you were standing on the top of World Trade Center 7, it would have been a bad choice. But if you were there at 5:21, and when the building started, the top floor started to go down, you had this ball in your hand, a heavy ball, and you dropped it for the first 2 seconds, you and the ball would have gone at the same speed. That's free fall. The gravitation is pulling the ball down and making it accelerate. The building was doing the same thing. Now, in this draft for public comment put out in August of 2008, it denied this, saying that the time it took for the upper floors, those are the only floors that you can see on the video, below that they disappear from view. The time it took for the upper floors to come down was approximately 40% longer than the computed freefall time and was consistent with physical principles, meaning with the law of physics. As this statement applies, any assertion that the building did come down in freefall would not be consistent with physical principles. Explaining why not, Sean Sunder said, a free fall time would be the fall time of an object that has no structural components below it. No steel, no concrete. The time that it took for those 17 floors to disappear was roughly 40% longer than free fall. And that is not at all unusual, because there was structural resistance that was provided in this particular case. All that steel and concrete. And you had a sequence of structural failures. Remember, one column leads to another. Sequential, progressive collapse. You had a sequence of structural failures that had to take place. Everything was not instantaneous. In saying this, Sunder was presupposing NIST's rejection of controlled demolition, which could have produced freefall collapse and instantaneous, by causing all 82 columns to fail simultaneously. He was rejecting that in favor of NIST's fire theory, which necessitated, as we've seen, a theory of progressive collapse. In response, high school physics teacher David Chandler, and I stress this because the physics here is very elementary. This is freshman level physics. Chandler challenged Sunder's denial of freefall, pointing out that Sunder's 40% claim contradicted a publicly visible, easily measurable quantity. So he put it on YouTube, slowed it way down so you could watch him measure it. Chandler then did this, and he said anyone knowing elementary physics watching this would see that for about 2.5 seconds, the acceleration of this building is indistinguishable from freefall. Now, amazingly, and rather than just ignoring this, I think NIST made a big mistake here, but they did it. In NIST's final report, which came out in November, NIST admitted freefall. Dividing the building's descent into three stages, NIST described the second phase as a free-fall descent over approximately 8 stories at gravitational acceleration for approximately 2.25 seconds. So they agreed completely with Chandler, except they quibbled. It was only 2.25 seconds, not 2.5 seconds. So, after presenting 600 pages of descriptions, testimonies, photographs, graphs, analysis, explanations and mathematical formula, this says, then a miracle happened. Why this would be a miracle was explained by Chandler, who said, free fall can only be achieved if there is zero resistance to the motion. Because if something's coming down and there's something in its way, if there's nothing in its way, then gravity is pulling it down, making it accelerate. It's using all of its energy to accelerate it. But if it has to use some of its energy to push things out of the way, then it's going to slow down. So there has to be zero resistance for free fall acceleration. In other words, the upper portion of Building 7 could have come down in free fall only if something had suddenly removed all the steel and concrete in the lower part of the building, which would have otherwise provided resistance. If everything had not been removed and the upper floors had come down in free fall anyway, even for only a second, a miracle, meaning a violation of the laws of physics, would have occurred. You'd have to say, praise be Allah. That was what Sundar himself had explained in the previous August, saying that a free-falling object would be one that has no structural component below it to offer resistance. But then in November, while still defending the same theory, the fire theory, that he had explained to make free fall impossible, NIST admitted free fall as an empirical factor. For a period of 2¼ seconds, the descent of World Trade Center 7 was characterized by gravitational acceleration free fall. Knowing that it had thereby affirmed miracle, these guys aren't stupid, they're just deceitful. Knowing that it had affirmed a miracle, NIST no longer claimed that its analysis was consistent with the laws of physics. In its August draft, in which it said the collapse was 40%, it's lower than free fall, NIST had repeatedly said that its analysis was consistent with physical principles. Time and time again, it repeats that phrase. But in its November report, every instance of that phrase has been removed. NIST thereby almost explicitly admitted that his report on World Trade Center 7, by admitting free fall while continuing to deny that it wasn't used, is not consistent with the principles of physics. The science of World Trade Center 7 is therefore settled. This fact is reflected in the agreement by hundreds of professionals with various forms of relevant expertise, architects, engineers, firefighters, physicists, and chemists, that this building was brought down by explosives. This truth has also recently been recognized by a symposium in one of our leading social science journals, American Behavioral Science. This symposium treats 9/11 as an example of what its authors call SCADs, State Crimes Against Democracy. State crimes. Criticizing the majority of the academic world for its blithe dismissal of more than one law of thermodynamics that is violated by the official theory of World Trade Center collapses. These authors also criticized the Academy for its failure to protest when Professor Stephen Jones, who was a physics professor at Brigham Young University and was the one who pioneered this research, including the nanothermite research and the Building 7 research, Professor Stephen Jones found himself forced out of a tenured position for merely reminding the world that physical laws, about which there is no dissent whatsoever in italics, contradict the official theory. So Jones is fired, and the AAUP does not protest. Maybe there was a slight little peep, but they didn't go to bat for him like they normally go to bat for professors who were fired unjustly, who had tenure. In any case, now the world can see, if it will only look, that's the hard part, to get people to look. I have a video, it's my favorite of my DVDs, called 9/11, Let's Get Empirical. That's the hardest thing, to get people to look at empirical evidence. So now the world can see, if it will only look, that even NIST in its final report did not dissent that these laws ruled out. By admitting the Building 7 came down in free fall for over 2 seconds, while simultaneously removing its previous claim that its report was consistent with physical principles. NIST implicitly admitted that the laws of physics rule out its non-demolition theory of this building's collapse. NIST thereby implicitly admitted that explosives were used. And with that implicit admission, NIST undermined the Al-Qaeda theory of 9/11. Why? For one thing, the straight-down nature of the collapse. How many of you have never seen Building 7 come down? So a few people have not. Well, it's a sight to behold. Here it is, standing perfectly still. And then all of a sudden at 5:21, it's better to see the video. I'm not my impersonation. You bring Stephen Gage, he'll show you all these. Richard Gage will bring you all these. They'll show you all these videos, and they're very impressive indeed. They convince first everybody who sees them. This is how he's got all his architects and engineers. He basically just shows them buildings, tells them coming down. They say, "Where can I sign?" Okay, the straight down collapse means that the building was subjected to the form of controlled demolition known as implosion, which is, in the words of the controlled demolition website, by far the trickiest kind of explosive project. The easy thing is just to knock a building over. This is very difficult, which only a handful of blasting companies in the world possess enough experience to perform. Al-Qaeda terrorists would have not had this kind of expertise. Second, the only reason to go to the trouble of bringing the building straight down is to avoid damaging nearby buildings. If the buildings, particularly the Twin Towers, had toppled over sideways, they would have destroyed dozens of other buildings and killed thousands of people. So, does anyone believe that, even if Al-Qaeda had the expertise to do that, they would have had the courtesy? A third problem is that foreign terrorists could not have obtained access to the buildings for all the hours it would have taken to plant explosives. Only insiders could have done that. The science of the collapse of World Trade Center 7 disproves the claim used to justify the war in Afghanistan that America was attacked by Al-Qaeda. It suggests instead that the 9/11 attacks were a false flag operation to provide a pretext to attack Muslim nations. The official rationale for our presence in Afghanistan is invalid. We are there for other reasons, which our political and military leaders dare not admit. The war is neither legally nor morally justified. It is, in fact, an abomination. We should demand that the troops be withdrawn immediately. Thank you very much.